To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
Welcome to the Death Panel. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. We could not do any of this without you. To help us out a little bit more, share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, hold listening or discussion groups, pick up copies of Health Communism and A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore, or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. I'm Beatrice Adler-Bolton, and today I am joined by my co-hosts, Artie Vierkant.
Hello.
And Jules Gill Peterson.
Hello.
And today, unfortunately, the three of us are going to be discussing the findings, impact, and fallout around a newly released report that leverages the kind of mode and medium of scientific evidence review in a way that threatens to worsen an already bad status quo of trans care for kids in the United Kingdom, called the CAS review. Many of our listeners have probably heard about this, but regardless, I'm just going to start us with some context here so everyone's on the same page. The CAS review is a large systematic literature review on the standards and practices of, to use the clinical term, gender-affirming medical care for kids in the UK that has reignited the age-old decontextualized narrative of the scary newness of medical transition for children that our brilliant co-host, Jules, actually happens to just be one of the world's leading experts in. This is the story in which children transitioning is very recent. The practice is exploding. Access to care is too easy, putting stress on physicians who are then pressured to provide access to hormones. And it's all so new, and the evidence and the data are lacking. And of course, you know, the toxic debate demands so-called sober compromise. All of this is very well-trod territory on this show, and all of this and more is covered in the CAS report. And so that's why we're addressing it today. And the report, just to give some background, was commissioned by the British National Health Service, the NHS. The final version of the report was released a little over 2 weeks ago in early April. And the formal title of the CAS review is actually the Independent Review of Gender Identity Services for Children and Young People. And it's being called the CAS review because it has been led by a retired NHS pediatric specialist named Dr. Hilary Cass, who specializes in care for children with complex chronic illnesses, disabilities, and also does palliative care for children, so not trans care. And since 2020, she has been leading this analysis, synthesis, and then the resulting report, which also involves the commissioning of a series of four massive literature reviews that were done on different areas of medicalized transition care. So the just under 400-page report has 10 key recommendations, from the assertion that trans care for children doesn't get held to the same high standards of evidence as other medical care and needs to be, to the need to beef up screening processes to better screen for so-called comorbid conditions like autism or mental illness, et cetera, to then, you know, it calls for emphasis on social transition, fertility counseling, reviewing the policy on puberty blockers, and of course, the need for more data and studies due to allegedly poor quality evidence. So it's a lot, and the exact implications of what will come from the review are still at this time unclear. But what has happened is that there has been an immediate explosion of discourse around what is essentially a thing that we actually talk about all the time on the show, which is the mode, method, and medium of systematic scientific evidence review and how it's leveraged by power and medical authority. And since a lot of the pushback to this has actually taken the form of debunking, perhaps in our opening thoughts, I thought we could just address why we're not going to be doing that today and why we're actually taking a different approach to discussing the CAS review.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we are. And, you know, partly because, as I am wont to say a lot these days, I strongly suspect that debunking is mostly ineffective politically. And part of that is that it concedes a lot to the people who are framing transition as a medical and psychiatric problem. And that, I think, is a political concession that not only rubs me the wrong way, I think it's actually tactically self-defeating. And in some ways, one way we might understand the CAS review is, in a totally non-conspiratorial sense, the direct outcome of about 70 or 80 years of medicalizing trans people and medicalizing transition in the first place. And that's why, you know, debunking sort of suggests that there is a correct scientific and medical paradigm or data set that can correct the bad information. And I think that just sort of fundamentally misunderstands how we got from, you know, an older regime of trans medicine to this one, which is by way of so many of the studies that are cited somewhat disingenuously or at times maliciously in the CAS review. So for me, I mean, just debunking, you know, it can be interesting and informational at the individual level. I think it's politically potentially kind of a largely a waste of time, although some debunking is kind of unavoidable, you know, just to explain to people how they're being misled and ideologically sort of captured. But yeah, ultimately, I'm just not sure that debunking will do anything here. The genre of this report, I think, is sort of structured around the idea that people will try to debunk it, and it's very invested in its kind of reasonableness, that it's sort of like the CAS review is here to basically be the adult in the room and stop all these emotional, ideologically biased groups of people from fighting. And so it's pretty hard to match that credibility at the level of emotion, because like, none of us have been commissioned by the NHS or, you know, the UK government to do this. That's sort of precisely the point. So yeah, I'm glad. Like, I'm so glad, though, it's that we get to do this on Death Panel, because it's really hard to even explain all of this in a lot of other venues. It's also pretty hard to avoid debunking. Like, I'm sure I'll end up doing a little bit of debunking, but maybe for a different purpose, right? Than sort of saying, you're wrong, I know the truth. Because I just think that that's just a political exercise to begin with. So we might as well just make the claims we want to make, because we have better reason to believe in them than some study told us we were right.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to what you're saying, to the extent that we'll be quote unquote debunking anything today, it will probably be in debunking the sort of underlying premise of medicalization as the one pathway for trans identity to be mediated through. But also just to kind of say, I guess, one thing about that too. I think, you know, Jules, you're right, as you mentioned, there are really good occasions in which to engage in debunking. You know, we've done plenty before about debunking people's claims on the science of masking and things like that. I think this actually is a really good example, though, that I've just kind of touched on, because if we were in a world where, you know, we were quote unquote following the science, right, I think pretty much everyone would be masking, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of an aside, though. I think that what I want to address is some of the things that I think are then easy criticisms by not engaging in the debunking, because I think, for example, you could very easily, I think the nature of this report, the difficulty of it is that it is very easy, I think, for people to get got by it. It has definitely this big veneer of authority. Even some of the people who have debunked it have used language like, this is the most comprehensive review that we've ever seen of this data set, you know, who then go on to say very critical things about it, but nevertheless, weirdly sing its praises. And that's, you know, that's a difficulty, because that just basically leaves the door open. And then I think you have sort of on the other side, you know, I think one of the big anti-trans crusader arguments that you hear is, you know, oh, clearly the activists just haven't read the whole thing. I guess it was too long for them. This is the, I'm thinking here of Benjamin Ryan, an independent journalist and sometimes contributor to the New York Times, who longtime Death Panel heads might remember as someone who's also been on kind of a crusade against, or rather a crusade as a sort of long COVID denialist in the past. Ryan's more recent crusade has been around the CAS review and trying to find a gotcha on basically anyone who's tried to do a debunk of it. And when I say this, like, that people are saying, oh, I guess it's too long to read, or something, that 388 pages and all this supplementary literature is, you know, too much for people. I'm saying that because Ryan literally says in one of his pieces about this, quote, I write as a dismayed middle-aged man who remains at his heart the same frustrated child who always did the reading before class and who was forced to sit and listen to those who hadn't done their homework dominate the discussion, unquote. Which, as an aside, I think is actually a funny and kind of appropriate description for the debate, because as someone who has on and off again been a university professor before, this is definitely a type of person, and they're often like the people who most dogmatically stick to whatever the thing that was assigned reading without taking a critical lens to it, and not trying to be shitty about students or anything, you know, bless the students and their solidarity encampments especially, but I'm just saying the debunk conversation, I think, often drifts into this sort of territory of competition to be a teacher's pet. Do You know,
yeah. I mean, it's a kind of lawyerly mode, right? It's a idea of winning on technicality and citations, and what the actual terms of debate are become defined by the kind of who can be most faithful to the source. I think a good analogy is like the way that constitutional originalism works, where you have people going back to the Constitution and saying, here it says X, and that means Y in today's terms, right? You have a lot of that in this debate, and that's why it's important to not engage it on its own terms.
And yeah. I just want to be clear, I bring this up because this sort of, I read the full report, and I suppose that you just didn't thing. I bring this up because I just want to be clear from the jump. I have read the whole report. I did. It's very long. I read it. I have thought about it. I am sure that the two of you did as well. And having read the full report, I agree completely with what you guys are saying. A debunk is not particularly what interests me here. There are very good debunks of it out there. You can go find them. Is the CAST report wrong, right? Or is the CAST report biased, whether intentionally biased or not? You bet, right? But you won't find that bias in the methods section, right?
Yeah.
That bias exists in the premise that trans identity needs to be mediated by medical expertise and physician opinion, as I already said. But, you know, it's just important to reiterate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate this. And there's maybe one more thing I would want to add. I also read the whole report. I've also am an unusual person in that I've read almost all of the medical literature and other literature cited in the report, you know, in the course of my day job. And I've also, you know, for over 10 years been carrying out systematic historical research in the history of this field. And so, you know, I mean this quite literally, with all due respect to the CAST report, in many ways, I think I do have access to a lot more information than the report makes available to itself. But one thing I think debunking just sort of structurally, one place it's weak is that it is reactionary or reactive, right? As you were both just saying, you end up having to respond to the opening argument, in this case made by the CAST report. It is very adversarial or litigious in that way. And of course, you can cross-examine, right? And you might be able to win in a sort of debate genre, but you'll miss a lot. And I actually think one thing that I hope, you know, we can get into this at some point, but one thing that I hope is actually reassuring and perhaps politically galvanizing to some extent for listeners trying to make sense of this is the report is certainly throwing around its heft and its, you know, its legitimacy in the sense that it's endorsed, you know, by a medical system and by a particular state. And in that sense, it is very distracting. It feels like a symptom of a series of political crises that are enveloping, you know, trans people in a number of different places, but the US and the UK being two that receive a lot of attention, understandably. And there is a way that debunking just sort of, it does kind of hold you in the present. You're trying to understand, how did this report happen? How could they, right? How could they say all these things that are not true? How could they be so cruel? And sometimes the answers to that are actually helpfully de-dramatizing. So I will say, just having read this report, from my perspective as a historian, it's not very novel at all. It's not particularly sophisticated. In fact, it doesn't really turn over any new argumentative ground. It is plugged into contemporary moral panics, particularly the moral panic around young transmasculine people as some kind of social disease spreading through the population for reasons that can never actually be stated because they don't exist. But other than that, you know, actually, it's a pretty conventional claim from just one historical strand in trans medicalization, which is a strand of people who support using psychotherapy and psychiatry to attempt to, you know, practice varying degrees of conversion therapy on people. And actually, for a long time, the sort of standard split in the way, you know, medicine tried to control trans people, quite literally control them, was that, you know, you would do everything you could with adults, but you couldn't really sort of practice conversion therapy on them against their will, because that just sort of is blatantly illegal even by the 1960s, but you could practice it on children because parents can give consent to that and children can't really do anything about it. And in that sense, this report really is just reviving a very long-standing disciplinary kind of cruelty and aggression that for a long time was the province of psychoanalysts, some psychologists, and quite a few psychiatrists that saw being trans as evidence of an undesirable dysgenic mental illness that should be eliminated from the social body by any means necessary. And, you know, at times could be in partnership with a kind of carceral logic that would involve institutionalizing, if not arresting and jailing or imprisoning people. And so in some ways, all this report is doing is just taking advantage of the fact that this has been a strong camp in medicine, in trans medicine, one that had, you know, basically had its legitimacy challenged over many decades and is now sort of, you know, the quote unquote minority perspective. But it remains right there available for anyone who wants to reactivate it. And many of the clinicians are still around, although they are certainly in the minority. And so in that sense, like part of what I would just say to put the CAST review in context and debunking couldn't do this, it's really not that novel, right? It didn't tender some real challenge that no one has seen coming or that we haven't seen before. And it's not really doing anything that sophisticated. It's just taking advantage of a lot of large-scale trends in medicine and, you know, basically weaponizing them to serve an ideological purpose. But I think that's sort of helpful to keep in mind. And so in that sense, we don't have to feel so motivated to correct its falsifications or its decontextualized claims as if that's the end of our critique, because in some ways that would sort of that would take it too seriously, and that would inflate its power and give it a kind of originality that I think it's really banking on. And I think it's worth sort of stating that outright. It's not very sophisticated. It's not really, you know, it's plenty contradictory. It's not a very good report, but part of why it's not very good is that it hasn't needed to be, is that like the prevailing conditions that restrict trans people's ability to transition, especially youth, created the world in which this report could basically just come into existence without anyone having to try too hard. And I do think that's worth saying, because the sort of heft again, and the way this report announces itself as usurping everyone else's power and getting to dictate the terms of the future does feel really intimidating. But I think it is helpful to say, no, it's really just doing something kind of obvious.
Absolutely. I think that the important way to think about the way that, for example, there's a kind of demand for how this report and review and process and its conclusions should be treated. And it's really relying on the kind of scale and volume of the final report, the purported neutrality, right? These terms are really asking us to engage in a point-by-point refutation in which we're buried
on its own terms.
Right, yeah, on its exactly. terms, in which we're buried in its paper, its sources, its perspective and context, right? And debating its claims. And that's something that for a long time we've been trying to think through how to refuse and work against in terms of how we think and discuss things. And part of what I feel like we might need to do at this point before we really dive into the specifics is actually contextualize this within the larger, longer story of trans children being new, which again, Jules, is your first book project. You have deep expertise in this when you alluded to some of the things that, you know, are not included in this report and not influencing this report, the background that you have. This is part of what you're talking about. And I think it's useful, instead of sort of thinking about this as something that exists on its own terms, to actually talk about it in terms of where it fits into the story of this narrative of transness in children is exploding. This is new and scary stuff. And now we need to do XYZ because
and dangerous and harmful, potentially, right. Et cetera.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. And it is, you know, harmful to move forward and carry beliefs without evidence, right? Because I think that it's important to kind of shove this thing back into the container in which it belongs, because the way that it puffs up and appears massive is like a cat puffing up its fur to appear bigger because it's scared. Then you see when all that hair is wet, it's a tiny scared little cat at the center of all that hair, right? And so what I really want to do is sort of take this report that really throws its weight around and tries to bury you in paper and bury you in evidence and just is a sort of self-reflexive testament to its own alleged neutrality, and actually just contextualize it within the very small circular story in which it actually plays a role.
Mm-hmm. That's so well put. And you're right. I mean, I think that's sort of the interesting thing about shifting away from debunking, because if you do have to contest, you know, one or two claims the report makes, but once you contest them, I mean, the report is sort of a house of cards that collapses in on itself because it is based on a series of assumptions that are easily falsifiable, mm-hmm. like blatantly easily. I mean, for no one more in the entire world probably than me, but you know, I wrote my book before the cast review was even a twinkle in the author's eye, so you know, take that for what it's worth. I think a couple of ways to think about this, right? It's really quite telling, actually, textually. So this report never speaks of trans children. You know, in the world of this report, there are no trans children. Right, children are not trans. Mm. In fact, there might be trans people, but they're always adults. So one, they just didn't exist as children or something. We can't actually know about that. We shouldn't ask about that too much. But children are developmental creatures, whose existence is always contingent, subject to change, and subject to adult authority. You know, so on the one hand, there can't have been trans kids, which is why the report basically says that children didn't transition until, you know, until the mid-1970s in Canada. And then, you know, the Dutch protocol in the 1980s is the invention of this paradigm, which, of course, blatantly untrue, as I drew attention to in some recent writing. Like, my book just shows you no, like, you could like just go look, right? There are earlier decades in which there are actually formal clinics dedicated to the treatment, quote unquote, treatment of trans children. Unfortunately for the report, that treatment is conversion therapy. However, because conversion therapy doesn't work, some of those clinics actually did let children medically transition. And so, you know, this report can't tell you that, right? It would not be an acceptable counterfact because it demolishes the grounding assumption of the report. And so instead of knowing anything about trans children, what do we get instead? This report, this is literally from the very beginning, page 20, says there are two kinds of people here. Young people who are questioning their gender identity is one group of people, right? And it's obviously implied that those people are probably not really trans. They're just questioning their gender identity. And then there's a second group, which is, you know, quote, experiencing gender dysphoria. So people experiencing a mental illness that needs to be treated. And that's just really it, right? That's as unsophisticated as, you know, the operator behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, right? It's just, oh, there are no trans people. There are people who are ill. And people who are ill are suffering distress is actually a key term that the report uses over and over. And people in distress can't be trusted and they have to be managed and they have to be made better. For what purpose? You know, so that they could function smoothly in the social body and in their families and in their schools. And, you know, not because we might do things to help them, you know, achieve the goals they have in life or just do things that they want, right? So, you know, that's the sleight of hand here. There are no trans kids historically. Trans kids are new. And in fact, there aren't even necessarily trans kids now. There are just children who are questioning their gender identity, which might be because they're on the internet too much or because they have an eating disorder. Or there are children experiencing gender dysphoria, which is sad and tragic and also bad and something that needs to be remedied, right? And so, I mean, in that sense, I think we really see what is going on. You know, the report says, at its heart are vulnerable young people and an NHS service unable to cope with demand. And so we see that children, you know, only have value insofar as they are vulnerable, incapable, and amenable to being ruled, and the NHS can't deal with it. But we won't say that's because of decades of austerity that have, you know, intentionally self-destructed the NHS and also policy decisions that have intolerably made medical transition impossible for a lot of young people and for some adults. So there's just a lot of things that have to be disappeared from the view, right? And that's, again, a little bit different than just debunking, right? Of course, some of the claims the report are making about trans youth are false. But I think what matters more is how they eliminate so much real-world context in order mm-hmm. to create a grounding assumption. And so if this assumption is untrue, then actually every single page that follows in the report is not convincing, right? It no longer has the kind of authority and power that it's claiming for itself. And it's sort of interesting that the foundational thing you have to do to make all of this work is to eliminate the very concept of trans children. And by trans children, I mean what I said in my first book, children who in the present tense of their childhood are trans. And we know they are trans because they say, I am trans.
Yeah.
Right. And it's really interesting. I think it's really telling that the only way you can write a 388-page report is to eliminate that in the first place.
To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to this and the rest of our catalog of patron-only episodes, and be the first to get a new patron episode every Monday when it drops. With love, the Death Panel.